In season one of Scene of the Crime, we explored the tragic 2017 double murder of Abigail Williams and Liberty German in Delphi, Indiana. Now, season two is upon us, and we are digging into another double murder. But this time around, the victims and circumstances couldn't be more different. Roger Atkison and Rose Burkert were brutally murdered in their hotel room at the Amana Holiday Inn in Williamsburg, Iowa, in September of 1980, and a killer wielding a heavy-bladed weapon in room 260, most likely a hatchet, would ensure that Roger and Rose didn't leave the hotel alive. Join us starting October 14th of 2020 as we kick off Season 2 of Scene of the Crime. Search for and subscribe to Scene of the Crime right now so you don't miss a single moment.
Hey everybody, welcome to Morbidology. I'd like to take a second to thank my new Patreon supporter, Elizabeth Byers. The support on Patreon helps to defray the costs of filing Freedom of Information requests, hosting, music licensing, equipment upgrades, and much more. I'm eternally grateful for any support up on Patreon, and in return, you get exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus each month, ad-free and early release episodes, polls, and you can even request a case for me to cover on the podcast. I'd also like to remind you all that Morbidology will be at CrimeCon in London next year in June, and I would love to see you there. Head on over to crimecon.co.uk and enter the promo code MORBID for 10% off your ticket. Next up is a quick word from my sponsor, and then on with the show. Myths, Magic, and Murder is a weekly horror comedy podcast hosted by Kate and Abby. From true crime and mysteries to myths and the paranormal, each week Kate and Abby cover cases that truly grip you from the very first minute. Each episode covers two different cases, and you can truly see how much research goes into each episode. They also share any theories or ideas and teach each other as they go. Kate and Abby are lifelong friends, and they easily bounce off each other, making for a light-hearted listen. So if you're a fan of true crime, mysteries, and all things absolutely terrifying, then make sure you subscribe to Myths, Magic, and Murder. They're available across all podcast platforms and are the perfect listen for Halloween season. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join me weekly as I uncover some of the world's most heinous murders. In early November of 2006, police in Wake County, North Carolina, were alerted to an upmarket home in a quiet and secluded neighborhood. Inside, they discovered tiny, bloody footprints that had been made by a wandering little girl who informed them that her mother had boo-boos everywhere. Her chilling words only hinted at the horror that they would find upstairs. It was around 1:30 p.m. on Friday the 3rd of November 2006 when police in Wake County, North Carolina, received a phone call from a woman identified as Meredith Fisher.
911 case emergency.
I need an ambulance. Okay. It's an emergency.
What address are you at, ma'am?
Birchley 5108 Birchleaf Road.
And your phone number?
Oh my God.
Ma'am, what's your phone number in case I lose you? Problem. Tell me exactly what happened.
I think my sister's dead.
Okay, tell me what happened, ma'am.
I have no idea. Oh my God.
All right, stay on the phone with me, please. What's your name?
Meredith Fisher.
Right, Meredith.
And this is a young address. Oh my God.
Meredith, listen to me, please.
Yeah.
Are you with the patient now?
Yes, it's her daughter.
Okay. How old is the patient?
And there's blood everywhere. She's 28, 29.
28.
Should I try to move her?
Listen to me, ma'am.
Yeah,
I'm going to tell you what to do.
Okay.
You need to calm down so we can help her. You said there's blood everywhere?
Yes.
All right. Is she conscious?
No, I don't think so. Should I try to help her?
Listen to me, ma'am.
I'm listening.
Is she breathing?
I don't think so.
Have you checked?
Michelle? She's cold.
Okay.
Meredith told the 911 operator that she had found her 29-year-old sister, Michelle Young, lying face down on the bedroom floor. She was cold to the touch and covered in blood.
Oh, my God. Michelle, I don't think so. She's so heavy.
I see if you can get her on her back.
I don't really think she's dead.
Pardon?
I really think she's dead.
Okay. Are you certain?
Hang on, Cassidy, sweetie, please go in your room. Okay, honey? I'm pretty sure.
You are?
No, I don't know.
Okay, we need to make sure.
Okay.
Can you get her on her back for me?
She's kind of twisted in a way that I can't do that.
You can't roll her over?
Not easily.
Are you going to have to try?
Hang on, I'm trying to see if I can get her pulse.
You missed it. We got to try to do CPR if we can get her on the back, Meredith.
So she's like cold.
She's cold?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
And her body is stiff.
Okay. Then don't try. If she's cold, then there's,
oh my God,
there's probably nothing else she can do.
Should I not touch anything?
All right. Try not to touch anything more than you did. Was anything out of place or unusual when you came in?
This place does not look like what it normally looks like.
Okay. What?
There's blood in the bed.
Okay. All right. Try not to touch anything else, okay?
Okay. I just moved a pillow.
I just leave everything exactly where it is then.
Okay.
There were tiny, bloody footprints throughout the house that had come from Michelle's 2-year-old daughter, Cassidy, who was unharmed but obviously very distressed, telling her aunt that her mother had boo-boos everywhere.
Listen to me, did you see what happened?
I don't know. Cassidy, come here, sweetie. I'm here with her daughter.
Okay.
Yes.
All right, stay on the phone.
Okay. Yes, sweetie. Sweetie, do you know what happened to Mommy? Did she fall?
She got a boo-boo everywhere.
All right, can you secure her daughter?
Cassidy, sweetie, can you stay in your room for 2 seconds, okay?
Okay.
Okay. Can you close the door for 2 seconds? I'll be right back in now, okay, sweetie? Okay.
Police were dispatched to the home at Birchleaf Drive in the Enchanted Oaks subdivision off Penny Road, just north of Lake Wheeler. Inside, it was evident that the victim was deceased and resuscitation efforts were futile. Michelle's cause of death was blunt force trauma. She had been brutally attacked and had suffered several fractures on the skull and jaw. Her neck showed signs of strangulation and she had lost several teeth. Even more crushing, Michelle was 4 months pregnant. Following the identification of the body, Wake County Sheriff Donnie Harrison made a statement which revealed that Michelle's husband, Jason Young, was out of town on business and had been visiting his parents in Brevard. Michelle was brought up in Sayville on Long Island. In high school, she made the cheerleading squad, and as her friend said, her upbeat attitude and constant smile made her a natural fit. From a young age, Michelle had already decided that she wanted to have a successful career as a tax attorney. As our friend Christy Trent said, she was one of those rare people who had everything together at such a young age. During spring of her senior year, Michelle travelled to Raleigh to try out for the North Carolina State cheerleading team. When she made the cut, she was ecstatic. She enrolled at North Carolina State University in fall of 1995 and settled in to her new life, almost 600 miles away from home. She joined a sorority and studied hard for her accounting classes. In 1997, Michelle and Jason met at the Have a Nice Day Cafe. Jason was also a student at North Carolina State University. In 1999, they both graduated from university, and in 2003, they were married. Michelle had always dreamed of having a family of her own, and just the following year, Michelle gave birth to their daughter, Cassidy. She quickly became the center of their universe. Michelle got a job as a senior financial specialist in the tax department of Progress Energy, where she was well-liked and well-respected, while Jason worked at Chart One, a medical software company. They were both very successful for their ages. The couple moved in to the typical upper-middle-class neighborhood located just outside the city limits of Raleigh in Wake County. It was remote, but still close enough to the city that it was the perfect location for a young working family. The large homes were set far apart and a thick tree canopy gave a sense of seclusion and safety. Jason and Michelle were both itching to add to their family, and in summer of 2006, Michelle discovered that she was pregnant. This time with a baby boy, who was due in spring of 2007. Since Jason was earning good money, Michelle had talked about cutting back her hours at work so that she could spend more time with the children. When Cassidy was born, Michelle had only taken 3 months' leave, and she was planning on taking 6 months' leave when she gave birth to their baby boy, before cutting down her hours. Investigators quickly got to piecing together the last known movements of Michelle. The day before Michelle's body was discovered, Jason went out of town for a business trip, which was around 300 miles away. He had been staying with his parents that night, who lived in that part of the state. It was determined that the last time that Michelle was seen alive was that night at around 10:30 p.m., when her friend, who had been at her house that evening for a catch-up, went home. That meant that there were 14 hours unaccounted for. Just the day after the murder, they announced that they did not believe that the murder was a random act of violence, and instead, Michelle had been targeted by somebody. The area that the family had lived was relatively remote. It wasn't in a town or a city, and investigators found it highly unlikely that it was just a random passerby. The sheriff made a public announcement asking anybody who noticed any vehicles near the family's home between 1 a.m. and 5 a.m. on the 2nd of November to please come forward. The murder completely stunned the upmarket neighborhood that Michelle had once called home. It's an area with very little crime and where a number of people kept their doors unlocked at night. Michelle, however, had always been safety conscious and made sure the windows and doors were locked each night, and had even got a dog for security purposes. Their neighbour, Tracy Pleasant, said, "We're still horrified. We're curious and we want some resolve. We're ready for investigators to give us some answers." As soon as news of his wife's murder reached Jason, he drove home from Bavard with his mother and his stepfather. Upon his return home, investigators seized his car and his luggage, as well as the luggage of the family members who had come with him. According to his stepfather, Gerald McIntyre, he had advised Jason to get a lawyer. It would soon be discovered that Meredith had been asked to go to the house by Jason, who said that he had sent over a fax that he didn't want his wife to see. According to Meredith, this was highly unusual. She had never been asked by Jason to do something like that before and believed that Michelle would have been out at work. Furthermore, there was no evidence that Michelle's killer had forced their way into the home. Just days later, Jason was ordered by a judge to provide investigators with fingerprints and footprints, as well as samples of blood, saliva, and hair. However, investigators were quick to say that they had no suspect in the murder, and as we all know, those closest to the victim are often the very first suspect. On the 8th of November, friends and family gathered at Brown Wynn Funeral Home on Raleigh Street for Michelle's wake. Afterwards, she was buried during a private burial at Wake Memorial Park in Cary. Alongside Michelle's name on her gravestone is the name Rylan for the son she was carrying. The son who lost his life before it had even begun. Shortly after the funeral, Michelle's mother, Linda Fisher, made a public plea for information about her daughter's murder. She begged, "I'm asking for anyone who has seen or heard anything, regardless of how trivial you think it is, to come forward and help us find the person who killed Michelle." She didn't mention Jason or the fact that he had been ordered to provide evidence, and said that she had faith the investigators would catch her daughter's killer. While Michelle was pregnant at the time of the murder, if anybody were ever apprehended for the murder, they could only be charged with one count as opposed to two. In several states, including Alaska and Georgia, killing a pregnant woman amounts to double homicide. However, efforts to adopt a fatal homicide statute in North Carolina the year before the murder had failed. In 1989, the state Supreme Court had ruled that killing a fetus by harming the mother does not constitute as murder unless the child initially survives before then passing away from their injuries. The first week dragged by with no new information regarding Michelle's murder. Then in early December, there was a bombshell revealed in search warrants that had finally been made public. It was revealed that Jason had been having an affair with Michelle Money, a woman who lived just outside Orlando in Florida. Money had gone to North Carolina State University with both Michelle and Jason and had been a sorority sister of Michelle. The affair had been going on for at least 3 months before Michelle's death, with Jason and Money being in constant contact either via text message, email, or phone. Investigators also obtained a search warrant to seize any computers and related equipment from Money's home in Florida. Wake County Sheriff's Major Richard Johnson said that they would currently not be providing any more information regarding the relationship between Jason and Money, but said that it was pretty self-explanatory. The search warrant further revealed that investigators had said that Jason had been uncooperative with their investigation and that they had seized two cell phones from Jason and were using phone records to try and determine where exactly Jason was when his wife was murdered. While the search warrant certainly alluded to Jason being a suspect in his wife's murder, the sheriff stopped short of naming him as a suspect. The new year brought fresh new leads when it was reported that blood had been discovered inside Jason's 2004 Ford Explorer. The car had been seized as evidence just the day after Michelle's body had been discovered. The car had been parked outside Michelle's mother, Linda's house. According to the search warrant, investigators discovered a blood drop on the seat behind the driver's seat, as well as a blood drop on the exterior side of the driver's door. As the information was released in the media, the sheriff also stated that Jason had still not properly spoken with investigators. Shortly after this grim update in the case, investigators announced that they were focusing on Jason as a suspect and had been focusing on him as a suspect from the very beginning. As it turned out, the couple had been experiencing financial problems and that Jason had a substantial life insurance policy on Michelle. According to the court order, investigators believed that Michelle's killer may have been injured during the struggle with Michelle, and they had wanted to examine Jason quickly because any injuries could heal with the passage of time. However, by this point in the investigation, Jason had still not made himself available to investigators. He had complied in submitting fingerprints and blood, but other than that, he had been uncooperative. In fact, investigators weren't exactly sure where Jason was. They believed that he was staying with his parents and daughter in Brevard, but they had been unable to get a hold of him. Meanwhile, Michelle's autopsy report was made public. It revealed that Michelle's lower left jaw and skull had been fractured numerous times. The beating had left at least 13 lacerations on the back of her head, and there was evidence of hemorrhaging on the brain. Fingernail markings were evident on the left side of her neck. Her lips were extremely bruised and swollen, and several of her teeth had been knocked out. When Michelle was murdered, she had been wearing a hoodie, a t-shirt, and black pants, and they were all saturated in blood. A strand of hair had been discovered in Michelle's hand, and medical examiners had been able to preserve the strand of hair and had been conducting forensic testing on it. As the weeks turned to months, it was revealed that in the run-up to Michelle's murder, she had been worried about money and had been upset about a trip that Jason had taken to California. Investigators had been keeping very tight-lipped about the case, and as Phyllis Stevens, a spokeswoman for the sheriff's office, said, the investigation was still a very active case, and there was a lot of evidence for them to go through. Michelle's mother, Linda, said that she believed that investigators were working their hardest for justice to be served. In February, Michelle's family gathered in Sayville, New York, to commemorate what would have been Michelle's birthday. Her mother said, I had a beautiful memorial service for Michelle. It was extremely comforting. She also said that she had not spoken to Jason at all since the murder. Shortly thereafter, Michelle's father, Alan, and Linda commemorated Victims' Rights Week by planting a tree which would launch the Michelle Marie Fisher Young Memorial Arbor Program. The program allowed families to choose a tree to be planted in memory of their loved one in any Islip Park in New York. The family were holding together as best as they could and trying to honor the life of Michelle. They had been offered a lot of support from Michelle's friends as well. One friend, Stasia Gossman, spoke with the News and Observer and said that she had moments where she thought about calling or emailing Michelle before remembering that she was never going to speak to Michelle again. She said that time had not helped fill the void left behind, but a conviction would. 6 months would pass until there was really any kind of significant update in the case. In May, it was revealed that a thorough examination to search for evidence of a sexual assault on Michelle had not been conducted. Crime scene investigators had requested that the pathologist use a sexual assault kit on Michelle when she was brought to the medical examiner's office for her autopsy. However, it was discovered that the pathologist, Thomas B. Clark, failed to perform the test. When this failure was revealed, Dr. John Butts, the state's chief medical examiner, said he did not know why Clark had failed to conduct the test, but said that he did look for bruising, tears, or other signs of rape and found no such injuries. Quite often, in homicide cases, crime scene investigators will request that the pathologist conduct a sexual assault kit, even if there is no kind of indication that the victim had been raped. With a sexual assault kit, sometimes the evidence will show that the victim had consensual sex before their murder, which can provide leads to investigators. In July, a $10,000 reward was offered by Progress Energy, where Michelle had worked. Mike Hughes, who was a spokesman for the company, said that a reward had been in the pipeline for some time, but they had been told that a reward fund may potentially hinder the investigation. However, as the 8-month investigation into Michelle's murder rolled around, investigators agreed that a reward may be helpful in generating some much-needed tips. By this point, it had become evident that investigators must not have enough evidence against Jason for an arrest. In November, it was the 1-year anniversary to Michelle's murder. Raleigh Police Major Richard Johnson said that after 1 year, progress in the case had slowed down. However, he also said that more progress was being made and hinted the possibility of a break in the case in the near future. He said that the main thing in the murder investigation was gathering enough evidence so that they could go before a judge. Before the month came to an end, investigators were back at the couple's home to reanalyze the crime scene. Investigators had been reviewing videos and photographs of the initial search of the home and realized that there were some stains and marks that had not been analyzed by the crime scene investigators. There had been numerous red footprints upstairs, but there was nothing in the photographs to show a scale of measurement to use for future analysis. There were no more public updates in the case for a number of months. In August of 2008, new owners moved into the home that Michelle was murdered in. As the young family were moving into their new home, a number of documents related to the murder were released. It was the first time since last year that new information had been publicized. According to the documents, DNA in blood spatter in the couple's bedroom had matched Jason's DNA. Furthermore, there had been two footprints in blood found on a pillow inside the bedroom. One impression was similar to the design of a pair of hush puppies that Jason owned. The other footprint had come from an athletic shoe. According to the search warrant that was publicized, Jason had purchased a pair of hush puppies and two pairs of athletic shoes in July of 2005 from a store in Cary. It was also revealed that the night before Michelle's body had been discovered, Jason had checked into a Hampton Inn hotel in Hillsville, Virginia, around 170 miles from Raleigh. The hotel CCTV camera had captured Jason checking in between 10:49 p.m. and 10:51 p.m. Then at 11:59 p.m., the CCTV camera captured Jason wearing a dark pullover as he walked towards the hotel exit. Hotel employees later discovered that somebody had placed a rock in the door, which prevented it from locking automatically and allowed people to enter without using a key card. After Jason left the hotel, his key card was not used to re-enter the hotel, and CCTV footage did not pick him up returning to his hotel room. The documents also revealed that at some point between 4 a.m. and 5 a.m. before Michelle's body was discovered, a newspaper carrier spotted a white Ford Explorer outside the Youngs' home, and investigators believed that this was Jason's white Ford Explorer. According to the newspaper carrier, the Young home stood out because it was extremely early in the morning, and yet all of the lights were on as if somebody were having a party. He described how the car had been parked in such a way that it appeared as though somebody may have been unloading or loading something. Later that afternoon, when Jason arrived at his mother's house in Brevard, he was not wearing the same dark pullover that he had been wearing on CCTV. Instead, he was wearing a white shirt and tie. According to his mother, he did not change clothing at her house, and the dark pullover was never found. Then when Jason was informed that his wife had been murdered, he refused to speak to investigators and had even hung up on them. Jason still had not been charged with murder, despite the fact that the documents made it quite evident that the investigation had focused on him. In November, it was the 2-year anniversary to Michelle's murder. A number of her loved ones gathered at her grave to release a dozen red and pink balloons, which contained messages for Michelle. Linda released a single blue balloon for the grandson she never got to meet. Podcorn are revolutionizing podcast sponsorships and connecting unique voices to unique brands. There was a time when only the big popular podcasts received sponsorships, but with Podcorn, indie podcasts such as Morbidology are able to work with amazing brands on their podcast. Podcorn have even sponsored this episode. Podcorn takes the confusion out of finding sponsorships for your podcast or finding a podcast to sponsor your brand. It is a simple and straightforward way for brands and podcasters to connect and either earn money for your podcast or advertise your product. All you need to do is sign up for free and begin browsing Podcorn's marketplace. The marketplace is easy to use and even has a handy calendar to take the stress out of booking multiple sponsors. One of the best things about Podcorn is that you have complete control over your spend as a brand or your price as a podcaster. Podcorn is an amazing way to connect podcasters to sponsorship opportunities, including host-read ads, interview segments, topical discussions, and more. So click the link in my show notes to sign up to Podcorn today. Just the following day, Linda filed a civil lawsuit which barred Jason from collecting any life insurance. She also wanted a superior court judge to stop Jason from acquiring any of Michelle's assets, and was seeking a determination by the court declaring that Jason willfully and unlawfully killed Michelle or was an accessory before the fact in her murder. Linda was additionally seeking at least $10,000 from Jason to compensate for her daughter's death, which was the standard minimum threshold for civil lawsuits in the Superior Court. Instead of Michelle's assets and life insurance payout going to Jason, Linda wanted it to go to her granddaughter, Cassidy. Asking a judge to declare somebody a killer is a highly unusual move and normally reserved for criminal courts. Just the following day, more search warrants were publicly released. These search warrants showed that Jason had Googled head trauma knockout before Michelle's murder on his work computer. They also showed that just the day before Michelle was murdered, Jason had exchanged around 50 calls and text messages with Michelle Money, the woman from Florida with whom he was having an affair. They further showed that on the day that Michelle's body was discovered, Jason had hung up on an investigator who had called him. He did not inquire as to his daughter's well-being or the cause of Michelle's death. The search warrants were the most comprehensive piece of evidence publicized to date. Jason subsequently defaulted on the wrongful death lawsuit which had been filed by Linda. According to Linda's attorney, Paul Michaels, by not responding, Jason is admitting guilt in the civil manner. This meant that a trial judge would now have to decide what, if anything, should be awarded to Linda as a result of the lack of action. It wouldn't be long before Jason was going to be hit with another filing. Linda and Meredith filed for custody of Cassidy, and a hearing to temporarily decide who would take care of her was scheduled for the 4th of February. In the custody complaint, they said that Jason and his family had not allowed them to have regular contact with Cassidy, and gifts that they had sent her had been returned unopened. The Fishers were also requesting a psychological evaluation of Jason and accused him in the complaint of having affairs with different women, not just Money, and allowing one to stay at the couple's home. They accused Jason of drinking to excess, berating Michelle publicly, and exposing himself frequently during social gatherings. When the court proceedings came around in February, Jason didn't show up to court, which meant that Linda and Meredith were awarded custody of Cassidy. Then in March, Jason did not show up to court, where a judge declared him civilly responsible for Michelle's death and wrote that he was liable for more than $15 million in damages. Linda stated that any money paid by Jason would go straight to Cassidy. There would be no update in the case until mid-December of 2009, when it was announced that Jason had been arrested and charged with first-degree murder. Jason had been arrested in Brevard and was transported back to Wake County. It was revealed that the case had gone before a grand jury, and they had decided to indict Jason on his wife's murder. During his first court appearance, he requested a public defender. Up until now, Jason had an attorney, but since the civil judgment that had been filed against him, he was now unable to afford one. He was appointed public defenders Brian Collins and Mike Klinkosum. In August, it was announced that prosecutors would not be seeking the death penalty against Jason. Following the announcement, Jason pleaded not guilty to the murder of Michelle. The first-degree murder trial began on the 7th of June 2011. During opening statements, the prosecution and the defence offered dramatically different versions of Jason's guilt. According to Wake County Assistant District Attorney Becky Holt, Jason had meticulously planned and then carried out the murder of Michelle. She said that Jason was surprised because he wasn't expecting there to be any kind of fight and wasn't expecting there to be blood. Instead, she put forward the theory that Jason believed that he would surprise Michelle and strangle her. She told the jury, "That's not what happened. He struck her and he struck her and there was blood all over the place. He left evidence he didn't expect to leave." Jason's defense attorney, Mike Klinkawesome, refuted this and accused the prosecution of not putting forward the entire story. He went on to state that a hair was found on a picture frame in the bedroom, which did not match either Jason or Michelle, and claimed that there was other evidence which would prove that Jason was not guilty. Turning to the jury, he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, this young man did not kill his wife. This case is not solved." He acknowledged that Jason had been unfaithful to his wife, but said that that did not make him a murderer. The first testimony of the trial came from Meredith Fisher, Michelle's sister, who had discovered her body. She told the jury that at 12:14 p.m., Jason had left her a voicemail asking her to drop by the couple's home to get a fax about a leather purse he had wanted to buy Michelle for an anniversary gift. Michelle thought that this request was quite strange. First of all, their anniversary had been back in October, and Jason rarely called her or asked her to do any kind of errands, especially at his house. When Meredith approached the home, she was surprised to see Michelle's car there and the front door unlocked. She opened the door and called out her sister's name, but received no response. As she proceeded up the stairs, she noticed red liquid, which she first of all thought was hair dye. However, when she peered into the bedroom, she saw the dead body of her sister. As tears trickled down her cheeks, she said, "I thought it was. It was just processing. I thought it was a joke. I didn't know what to think. I started to panic. I went to the other side of the bed, got the phone, and started to call 911. She said that as she started to dial for help, Cassidy looked up from underneath the blanket on the bed and just stared at Meredith, who had no idea that Cassidy was there. She described how Cassidy climbed off the bed, ran to her, and hugged her. She kept saying that her mother had boo-boos everywhere. Meredith told the jury that she checked Michelle's body and found that she was ice cold. Later on, Meredith said that she was at her home with her mother, Jason, Cassidy, and a few other family members. She said that police arrived to take statements, but Jason repeatedly refused to speak to them. He was in a bedroom with Cassidy when Meredith asked him to come to the door and speak to police, but he flat out refused. She said that police explained that Michelle had been murdered and they needed to ask certain questions about things that may be missing in the house. She also said that eventually Jason gave her a hug and made a noise like he was crying, but said that there were no actual tears coming from his eyes. She said that Jason's refusal to speak to police and answer any questions from family members caused her concerns to grow. She spoke about the relationship between Michelle and Jason and said that it was tense and marred by arguments. In fact, the marriage had been so difficult that at times the couple only corresponded by email, or the conversations would just lead to slamming doors and silent treatment. According to Meredith, at times, she had worked as a sort of marriage counsellor for Michelle and Jason. Michelle had complained that Jason was immature, that he wanted to get drunk with his friends all the time, and that he was not meeting her needs and expectations. Jason complained about their sex life. In early November, Michelle had told her sister that she had had enough of the marriage and things couldn't continue the way they had been. Just 5 days later, Michelle was beaten to death. Michelle's mother, Linda, would also testify about the rocky relationship. She said that Michelle had become pregnant, which was what led to the couple getting married. She said that she had raised concerns with Jason and told him not to marry her if he didn't love her.
I know, but how hard it is to stay in a good marriage and be in a happy marriage. But basically, I told him, if you don't love her, then don't marry her.
She described how the couple would have screaming matches and how Jason would often belittle Michelle, mock her, and put her down. She said that towards the end of Michelle's life, she appeared to be despondent, as if she was empty and had nothing to live for.
When I was there that last time in October, we were sitting watching TV, and she had her head on my lap, and she was lying out, and I was stroking her hair, and she was empty. She was just, it was almost like nothing to live for. You know, she loved life, and he took it away from her. Just took it away from her.
Her testimony was followed by Dr. Thomas Clark, the pathologist who had performed the autopsy in Chapel Hill. He described how he had found multiple blows, including blows to the head, upper arm, and face. Several teeth had been knocked out, and there was extensive lacerations to the left side and fractures to the skull and jawbone. He said that there had been at least 30 blows, and there were bruises on both of her hands, indicating that Michelle had put up a fight. He stated that most of the injuries would have come from a weapon, but said that some could have been done with a fist. He said, "The only thing I can say about the weapon is it was heavy, and it was definitely a blunt object." On the second day of the trial, Shelley Shad testified. Shelley was a longtime friend of Michelle and was the friend who had spent the evening at Michelle's house before her murder. She said that while there, Michelle had spoken about a recent argument she had had with Jason about the upcoming holidays. They had planned on visiting Jason's family in Brevard for Thanksgiving, but Michelle had been upset that Jason did not want her own mother, Linda, to come. The couple had also been arguing about Christmas. Linda had wanted to come into town for 2 weeks over the Christmas period, but Jason did not want her staying in their home. Shelley said that Michelle and Jason were so different personality-wise that they clashed. Michelle was a planner and Jason was a procrastinator. She said that Jason often did things that raised eyebrows. She said that at her pre-wedding party, Jason took up a dare and urinated in his trousers in the middle of the room. Shelley's husband had to help Jason into the shower, and when he got out, he paraded around the party naked. She said that on several other occasions he had exposed himself at parties and had embarrassed Michelle. According to Shelley, when she went to Michelle's house the night of the murder, she had a strange feeling that she and Michelle were being watched. In fact, she had felt so strange that she asked Michelle to walk her back to her car when she left that night. She hugged her and said goodbye. She was the last person, other than Cassidy, to ever see Michelle alive. Her testimony was followed by a testimony from hotel staff at the Hampton Inn in Hillville, Virginia, where Jason had checked into shortly before 11 p.m. According to a night auditor at the hotel, between 3:30 a.m. and 4 a.m, a camera in the west stairwell had been shut off, and a rock had been used to prop open the side door.
November the 3rd of 2006, when you came into work, did you hear about a problem with one of the cameras that Mr. Hicks told you about?
Yes, I seen it when I was out.
Okay. What did you see? What happened?
Well, we noticed one of the cameras was out, so we went and checked to see which one it was and figured it out and went to check it, and it was unplugged.
Okay. Where was this camera located?
It was located in the stairway in the west end of the building.
What did you see then when you went and looked at this camera?
It was unplugged.
Okay, so what did you do?
Went and got a stepladder and plugged it back up.
He had been unable to reach the camera, so the maintenance man who arrived at 5 a.m. fixed it. it was known without a doubt that Jason had checked into the hotel for business purposes. According to the defense, he had stayed in the hotel all night, but according to the prosecution, he had left the hotel shortly before midnight, made the drive back to Raleigh, killed his wife, and then drove back to the hotel. CCTV footage had captured Jason exiting the hotel through the lobby just before midnight, and a key card reader from the hotel showed no entries to the room that he had booked, except by the housekeepers. The key card reader could not show exits. A convenience store clerk from King, a small town around 40 miles from the hotel, testified that she had sold Jason gas that morning. Gracie Dams from Four Brothers Food Store said that the encounter had taken place around 5:30 a.m. on the 3rd of November 2006. It struck out in her mind because the man had been rude. She said that when she worked the shift alone, she often set the pumps up so that customers paying with cash had to come inside before filling up their cars. She would tell customers that weren't regulars that they could either pay by cash at the register or leave a credit card and photo ID with her before she would start the pump. That way, it prevented people from filling up their car and then driving away before paying. She said that Jason threw down $20, pumped only $15 in gas, and then didn't come back for his change. The next day, the jury were to hear some graphic testimony regarding the crime scene. Michelle had been beaten so brutally that crime scene investigators had found her smashed teeth on the bedroom floor. The jury were shown a videotape tour of the Youngs' home. It showed large amounts of blood on the bedroom floor and on the bed, as well as tiny bloody footprints which tracked from the bedroom to a hallway bathroom.
There is some bloody small footwear impressions that lead into the hall bathroom.
What are you looking at here?
This is the hall bathroom, later identified as Cassidy's bathroom. Got bloody footwear impressions with a stool, a sock, looks like a bathrobe.
And are the bloody footprints actually on that stool that you're focusing on now?
Yes, ma'am.
And as well as other areas in the bathroom?
Yes, ma'am.
What are you showing here?
That's the bloody sock, a robe on the wall. Here, appears to be bloody footwear impressions. I found her with her head against the door right at the plane, and her feet that was underneath, partially underneath the bed. I got a trail of blood drops leading from the bed, a massive amount of blood here. There are the bloody footwear impressions inside the closet, and there is a large amount of blood that is on the wall. And here are the throw pillows. The pillow with the footwear impression on it.
Michelle had been discovered lying on her stomach with her feet partially under the bed. There were pillows, including one with a bloody shoe print, surrounding her body. Cassidy had also placed a baby doll by her head. In regards to the footprints, Karen Morrow, a latent prints examiner, said that she had found impressions from a pair of size 10 Franklin athletic shoes, as well as a pair of size 12 hush puppies. The footprints were on the pillows, bedding, and papers inside the bedroom. However, investigators had never been able to find the shoes that they had come from. They had been able to find that Jason had purchased a pair of hush puppies in July of 2005, but they were never able to find those shoes or any of the clothing that Jason was wearing when the hotel CCTV picked him up, leaving before midnight. Mike Galloway, a crime scene investigator with the City County Bureau of Identification, testified that he had examined Jason for injuries and found no evidence of abrasions, bruises, or swelling, and only found a blackened toenail on his left foot. He further testified that Michelle was most likely first attacked when she was lying in bed. Brent David, an investigator with the Wake County Sheriff's Department, told the jury that Michelle's wedding rings had never been found, despite the fact there had been numerous searches in the home for them. Furthermore, two drawers were missing from her jewelry box, and they were never recovered either. While it had been reported early on in the case that blood had been discovered in Jason's white Ford Explorer, it would be revealed that this wasn't the case. No blood had been discovered inside his vehicle, and there had been no fibre transfer from the Hampton Inn and the Youngs' home. His DNA had been discovered on a portion of the wall near the bedroom closet, but the DNA was not from blood, and as his defence pointed out, it was not uncommon for someone's DNA to be found in their own bedroom. It was further revealed that DNA had been found from two men on two cigarette butts at the scene, neither of which were Jason. An unidentified hair had also been collected from the crime scene, and unknown DNA was found on one of Jason's sneakers that they had retrieved after he moved to Brevard. In terms of computer forensics, an expert would testify that Jason had Googled some extremely disturbing terms.
I found two search queries on Yahoo.com. One is anatomy of a knockout, and the other is head trauma blackout.
He had also Googled on ask.com head blow knockout and searched WebMD for head trauma. Michelle Money was also called to testify. She told the jury that she had been having an affair with Jason. She said that in October of 2006, Jason had visited her in Florida over a weekend and they had continued to talk daily. In fact, at one point during the affair, Money had gone to Michelle's home in Wake County. She said that she and Jason had spoken after Michelle's death and that she had been hounded by investigators and the media and that she didn't want photographs of her child plastered across newspapers. She claimed that despite the fact she was sleeping with Michelle's husband, she still considered Michelle one of her friends, and that she had absolutely no knowledge of her murder. Her testimony was followed by Carol Ann Sowerby, who divulged that she had a one-night stand with Jason several weeks before Michelle's murder. She said that she had known Jason for years after he was her instructor at a summer camp, and she was a camper. One night, when Michelle was out of town on business, Jason had invited Carol over to their home, where they had a one-night stand. Jason's ex-fiance also testified. Genevieve Cargill had been engaged to Jason, and she told the jury that he had been physically abusive towards her during their relationship. She highlighted an event where Jason had thrown her onto a bed, jumped on her with all of his weight, and pulled her arms back so brutally that she believed her arms were going to pop out of their sockets. He demanded the engagement ring back, but since it was too small, Genevieve had struggled to get it off her finger. He yanked the ring so hard that he cut Genevieve's finger. She recollected, his eyes were glazed over, and he didn't show any emotion. Then around 2 months before Michelle was murdered, Jason had emailed Genevieve and professed his continued love for her and desire to see her again. Genevieve ignored the email. The final witness for the prosecution was Sergeant Richard Spivey. He told the jury that when Jason left the hotel shortly before midnight, before Michelle's murder, he was wearing different clothing than when he checked in. He said it looked as though he was wearing brown slip-on shoes with a rounded toe, which could have possibly matched the hush puppy shoe print found at the crime scene. Neither set of clothing were ever found, and neither were the shoes. He additionally revealed that Jason had purchased a new pair of shoes on the 4th of November, hours before he was to meet with investigators so that they could seize DNA samples. He also testified about a medicine dropper found inside Cassidy's room. The dropper showed traces of dihydracodeine, a prescription drug that causes drowsiness. The prosecution suggested that Jason, who was a medical software salesman for a pharmaceutical company, could have easily had access to the drug and used it to immobilize his daughter. A bottle of Tylenol was also found in Cassidy's room, and an unidentified fingerprint was discovered on the cap. He described how the distance between the hotel and the Youngs' home was 160 miles, and that Jason could have easily driven there in 2 hours and 40 minutes, or less, with no traffic. The distance from the Youngs' home and the Four Brothers convenience store in King is 121 miles, and the drive would have taken around 1 hour and 45 minutes. Jason was allegedly seen in the store at around 5:30 a.m., which meant he had around an hour to kill Michelle. As mentioned earlier, the CCTV camera at the hotel had been inexplicably turned off. Well, when that was discovered, it was of course turned back on. However, it was discovered that at 6:38 that morning, a camera on the west side exit at the hotel had been shoved towards the ceiling. The distance between King's, where the convenience store is located, and the hotel was 49 miles. According to the sergeant's testimony, it would have been possible for Jason to drive to Raleigh, commit the murder, and drive back in the time frame that had been presented. Prosecutors had succeeded in showing a pattern of infidelity and violence by calling a number of women to testify. They had portrayed an image of an alcoholic with unpredictable behaviour and cruel behaviour. It was evident that much of their case hinged on circumstantial evidence, and Jason's defence asked the judge to dismiss the murder charge. Judge Donald Stevens refused and stated he had heard enough evidence to send the case to the jury. The defence next put Jason's mother, Pat Young, on the witness stand. Pat gave an emotional account of how Jason was at her house when he learned that Michelle was dead. Pat had been told of the murder by Linda, and when Jason arrived at her home at around 5 p.m, she said that she didn't quite know how to inform her son that his wife was dead. She said that Jason knew something was wrong and asked her if she was okay. Her husband, Gerald, blurted out that Michelle was dead. According to Pat, Jason went pale and sank to the ground before crying and asking about Cassidy. She said that on the way to Meredith's house after the murder, one of Jason's friends had told him that he shouldn't go there unless he had a lawyer. While there had been an abundance of testimony regarding the tumultuous relationship of Michelle and Jason, when Pat testified, she completely downplayed it. She said she believed that Jason loved Michelle very much and said that when they argued, they would be fine within minutes. It was a stark difference to earlier testimony wherein people said that the couple spoke through emails because they refused to speak in person. Her testimony was followed by other relatives, including Jason's stepfather, his younger sister, and several friends. They, too, offered a different portrait of Jason. They described him as a grief-stricken, an inconsolable man. They also said that Jason was excited about welcoming his second child into the world and was excited about having a baby boy who could pass along the Young name. A neighbour, Cindy Beaver, also testified that at around 5:30 a.m. on the 3rd of November, she had noticed a van pulling out of the couple's driveway.
And so you saw this car, I guess, at the driveway?
Yes.
You said it was facing virtually...
Correct.
Okay, what else did you observe?
Well, I drive with my bright lights on to look for deer, and immediately there's a little curve, like if this is the part, the car, there's a little bit of a curve before you straighten back up again, and my bright lights hit the car, and there were two people in the car, a driver and a passenger. The passenger, I assumed, was a woman. I don't know. When my bright lights hit the passenger, that person quickly jerked their head away. It was, you know, very obvious. And my first concern was, oh, gosh, I've just blinded this person at this time of the morning on their way out, you know, with my bright lights. And but that jerking motion away, so I didn't actually see the face, could tell anything about it. I'm just judging maybe by the hairstyle or whatever that it was a woman with them, but I don't know.
She said that there was a male driver, and she believed that she may have seen a female passenger. Terry Tillery, a newspaper carrier, also testified that she had seen a minivan near the home at around 3:30 a.m. on the 3rd of November. She described it as either a light-coloured or silver SUV. The final person to testify during the trial was Jason himself. He emphatically stated that he did not murder Michelle. Prosecutor Becky Holt asked Jason why he waited more than 4 years after his wife's murder to tell investigators where he was in the hours before and after Michelle was killed. He insisted that he was following the advice of his attorney. He spoke about meeting Michelle for the first time and believing that she was out of his league.
Did there come a time when you learned that she was pregnant?
Yes.
Tell us about that. How did you find that out? What was your reaction?
That was at the townhome at Arete Way that Ryan and I had purchased. And I remember I was upstairs in the bedroom, and Michelle went, we were in the master bedroom, and there's a bathroom attached to that. And I remember Michelle coming out and announcing that she was pregnant.
What was your reaction to that?
We were both very shocked. We were both eye-opening, like, whoa. It was a surprise. It wasn't planned, but it was a surprise, but it was a good surprise.
Do you remember telling your mom about that?
I do.
Describe that conversation. Was that the way it happened?
Yes, it was. I think Michelle was nervous about that, and she was like, "You really just want to tell your mom like that?" I'm like, "Yeah, I don't think Michelle knew at that point how close." Like, I was like, "Mom, well, this will be a good thing. Mom will be so excited to be a grandmom." I'm like, "This will be a really neat thing for her." So I actually was pretty excited to tell my mom.
She testified that she told you, if you love her, marry her.
Yes.
And did you?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, I did.
He spoke about the ups and downs of the relationship and the enthusiasm they shared on the birth of their daughter. He admitted that he had been a bad husband and relayed regret over the violence he had inflicted on his former fiance. He said that he had checked into the hotel and confirmed that he did leave because he allegedly left a charger in his car. He said that he did not pull his hotel room door to a close, which was why the key card reader never picked him up returning to the hotel room. He claimed that he had left the door ajar and went down an outside staircase. He said that he realized the door would lock if he closed it and claimed he put some twigs from a nearby bush between the door and jamb to keep it from closing. He said that he then returned to his hotel room. He said that he went outside a short time later to smoke a cigar. He claimed he returned to the hotel room using the same staircase where he had propped the outside door open. According to Jason, this was why CCTV never picked him up returning to the hotel. Closing arguments were to follow. The prosecution stated, "There's no one thing that we're going to tell you and show you and bring to you that's going to say the defendant is a killer. It's all of it. It's the totality of it. There's too much pointing to the defendant to think otherwise, that it couldn't be the defendant." The defense, on the other hand, urged the jury to carefully review the DNA evidence, the timeline, and the testimony of Jason's friends and family. Attorney Klinkosum said, "The circumstances point to the fact that he is not the one who killed his wife." The case was sent to the jury to deliberate. After 4 days, the jury could still not make a decision. They were split 8-4 on an acquittal. They informed the judge that it was a hung jury and that they were immovably divided. Judge Donald Stevens had no choice but to declare a mistrial. It was then announced that Jason would be retried in early October. The following month, Jason was released on $900,000 bond, which had been paid for by his parents. The retrial was subsequently pushed back until January of 2012. The retrial would follow a similar format to the original trial, with all of the same evidence presented. This time, Michelle's therapist testified. Jane Sargent told the jury that Michelle came to her awake before she was murdered. She said that Michelle was upset and frustrated with her marriage. She complained about a lack of intimacy, communication problems, and feeling that her husband often forced himself onto her sexually. She said that other counselors they had seen together said that Jason had anger issues. Phone records were also entered as evidence. They showed that Jason was speaking with friends and family on his phone on the way to Virginia. However, there had been no cell phone activity between 11:42 p.m. on the 2nd of November and 7:40 a.m. on the 3rd of November, the crucial time frame. This time, Jason decided not to testify. During closing arguments, Attorney Klinkosim told the jury to do their duty and find Jason not guilty of murder. He reiterated that there was no direct evidence to tie Jason to the murder of Michelle. Prosecutor Becky Holt told the jury that Jason had a plan to murder his wife and had waited years before telling his story. The reason for this, she said, was so that he could see the evidence that the state had against him and then concoct his story to fit with it. Prosecutor Cummings wrapped up the case by stating that there was no robbery, no sexual assault, and no forced entry. He said, 30 blows, that's not from a stranger. That's from a mad, mad domestic abuser. This time, the jury reached a unanimous decision and found Jason Young guilty of first-degree murder. The first-degree murder conviction meant an automatic sentence of life without the possibility of parole. After the verdict was read out, Jason declined to make a statement. Judge Donald Stevens said that the case was one of long and simmering domestic violence. He said, "This woman wasn't just murdered. She suffered a beating the likes of what we seldom see." Linda and Meredith broke down in tears as the verdict was announced. They hugged prosecutors and investigators, as well as others who had attended the trial. In July of 2013, Jason's lawyers filed an appeal for the murder conviction, and then in 2014, the North Carolina Court of Appeals granted a new trial for Jason. The three-judge appellate panel ruled that evidence about the wrongful death lawsuit and custody proceedings from civil court had hampered Jason's ability to get a fair trial. However, the state Supreme Court overruled that decision. In August of 2017, Jason was denied a third trial.
When I was there that last time in October, we were sitting watching TV. She had her head on my lap. And she was lying out, and I was stroking her hair. And she was empty. She was just, it was almost like nothing to live for. You know, she loved life. And he took it away from her. He just took it away from her.
The murder of Michelle Young was a brutal and targeted attack. To beat somebody so violently that their teeth are shattered out of their mouth takes some level of emotion, some level of rage. A conviction on circumstantial evidence can certainly be a lot more difficult to achieve, but circumstantial evidence can be like pieces of a puzzle. When placed together, they fit to show the whole picture, and to many, that picture clearly showed a pattern of infidelity, anger, and hopelessness. Nevertheless, Jason Young still has a number of supporters who wholeheartedly believe that Jason was wrongfully convicted. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I already said it at the start of the episode, but once again, thank you so much to my Patreon supporters. I am eternally grateful for the support up on there, but also for the support of just listening to an episode, commenting on an episode, following me on social media. Thank you so, so much. Can I also ask that if you enjoy Morbidology, please consider leaving me a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening. Ratings and reviews are an easy way to support a podcast that you like. I'd also like to let you all know that I have a special episode of Morbidology coming out on Halloween morning, so keep your eyes peeled for that. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.